This call is now being recorded.
Okay, the call is being recorded. The story that I am doing looks at what a comprehensive coronavirus strategy should look like. And a big piece of that, obviously, is effective communication with the public. And, obviously, there have been a lot of mistakes along the way, but I'd really like to talk about some of the ways that it could more about what could be positive as opposed to, all the blunders of the past year, although I do want to touch on that as well. One of my big questions was going to be, and keeping in mind too, that we're sort of in a different place than we were even 9 months ago, now that we have this vaccine and that it's gone out. But that becomes a big part of the strategy as well, in terms of educating the public about the importance of getting the vaccine and knowing that it's safe and things like that. Should there be some kind of a public information campaign, ads that go out to be able to tell the public that this is safe? So far, most of what I've seen has been on social media, but should the government do some sort of educational campaign to say, go out and get your vaccine? And at what point should that happen?
Well, I mean, there are sort of two answers to that. Which add up to an answer of yes and it almost goes without saying with something as important as vaccine uptake that there ought to be some kind of public service communication campaign coming out of the government. It also immediately almost goes without saying that it won't do much good because trust in the government is relatively low. And people, the people who are going to be responsive to that campaign are already the ones who intend to get vaccinated. And, they'll notice the campaign and point it out to their friends who are not inclined to get vaccinated. And their friends will say, "You still trust the government? What's wrong with you? Haven't you been paying any attention, to all the ways the government has betrayed us?" The persuasion that's going to matter, if you sort of say, okay, they're the people who are going to get vaccinated and they know it already. There are the people who are not going to get vaccinated and they know it already. If it becomes compulsory or compulsory in the private sector, their boss makes them or something, maybe they'll change their mind, but they're determined not to if they can manage not to. And then there's a group in the middle, or actually several groups in the middle. One group in the middle fully intends to get vaccinated, but it wants to wait. Given that we haven't got enough doses for everybody anyway, it's in my judgment, incredibly foolish to tell people who want to wait that they shouldn't want to wait when they have to wait. people who are lingering at the back of the line and anxious to see others go ahead of them so they can watch and see how it goes. The right response to them is thank you. Thank you for letting us get ahead of you in line. I would not put any pressure at this point on anybody to move higher up in the vaccination hierarchy than they want to be. It's pretty rational to say, this is new. It hasn't been all that well tested. I never like getting medicines that are newly out. I like to get last year's medicine, not this year's medicine. I buy last year's car too. I want to wait till the lemons are out of it. I don't update my computer the minute the update comes out either. I'm one of those people that doesn't want to be an early adopter. I'm sort of taking on the voice of such a person, then let them wait. And, these are people who are going to get vaccinated, 2 or 3 months after they first can. And I think, that's just fine. Then there's the group that really needs to be communicated at who are reluctant, but not a lost cause. They are suspicious. They're skeptical. They're worried. But they're not determined not to get vaccinated. And it's not about just watching for a few months, and they're going to be amenable to communication, but maybe not communication from the government. It's going to matter a lot more what their doctor says. It's going to matter what their friends and neighbors say. People have a very strong desire to be members of the team. And one of the problems, and you know this, Kimberly, but I think it's worth emphasizing anyway. I mean, one of the problems of COVID-19 response is it has been polarized. Instead of one team, we're two teams. Yes. And the red team and the blue team are pointing in different directions and taking different precautions and different attitudes toward precautions. And I don't think that was inevitable, but it certainly happened. And everybody, and this it's not like this is only true of Republicans, it's every bit as true as of Democrats. Everybody is much more motivated to be loyal members of the team than they are motivated to make up their own minds what to do. So the people who are reluctant to get vaccinated are going to be much less attentive to a government that may not be the government they voted for anyway, than they will be to the people they think are on their team. So if I were going to design a campaign to reach those people, it would get localized. It would have lots of local champions. And it would be particularly looking for champions who share values with the reluctant but not out of reach audience. Mm-hmm. And that might be religious leaders. Certainly for some communities, it is religious leaders. For some communities, it's educational leaders. For some communities, it's political leaders. I don't begin to know exactly under what circumstances you get Donald Trump to make a pro-vaccination PSA. But it's not out of the question, and there's a huge audience for whom that would be very meaningful. Mm-hmm. There needs to be a campaign, but I'm not looking for one massive campaign. I'm looking for lots of campaigns that are informed by our understanding of how specific audiences are likely to respond.
That's really interesting. I didn't think of it that way. I've been seeing another thing I've been seeing is a few people saying that there should be some sort of an informational campaign about the dangers of COVID-19 when it becomes really severe, and getting the message out about, not just deaths, but the long-term effects and what it's like to be on a ventilator and things like that, in a similar way to, some of the anti-drug or anti-smoking ads that we've had in the past. What would you think of something like that?
Fear as a motivator has had a bad press. There are a lot of people who imagine that scaring people is not useful, and there's lots and lots of evidence that they're wrong. That scaring people is useful. Mm-hmm. It can go too far. It's a U curve. If people are insufficiently frightened, they're not motivated. If people are excessively frightened, they're paralyzed, and they're motivated, but they're motivated to hide rather than to take appropriate precautions. Too much fear exists, but that's not the usual problem. The usual problem is too little fear. Mm-hmm. All the available social science says, if you've got an audience that's not frightened enough about COVID-19, then it will be useful to frighten them. And to be sure, people are more frightened by images and anecdotes than they are by statistics. So it's not going to be the data that convinces people that they are at risk. It's going to be, most productively, sadly, the experience of someone they actually know and care about that becomes meaningful. But you can replicate that. You can tell stories of people who you know, thought it was no big deal and went to a rally or went to a party and just barely lived to regret it after a horrible time on the ICU on a ventilator. And that, you know, that's a story worth telling for that segment of the audience. It's not everybody that needs to hear that. There are people who have heard that enough already, and for them, the barrier is something else. But, you know, insofar as there's an audience that's not frightened enough, then yes, scaring them is useful. I have to sort of add a footnote that sometimes people who are very frightened will pretend to be not frightened enough. You know, that, I mean, denial masquerades as apathy. So if there are people that can't bear to think about getting COVID-19 because it's too terrifying, you know, then trying to terrify those people is gonna backfire. It's just gonna push them more deeply into denial. I don't know. I mean, my intuition is that COVID-19 denial is not a big deal. That there aren't a lot of people so frightened they're pretending to be apathetic, but it's kind of a footnote I'm used to adding when advising any client to go scare people, is make sure they're not scared enough before you go scare them.
Right. Does that make sense? It does. I was just thinking about it too, because, you know, I spend a good amount of time talking to people outside of, you know, DC and what the political messages are and all those things. And, you know, a lot of people just experience this crisis differently. They've experienced it more as an economic crisis than a health one, you know, where they might know more people who are out of work than they do who've had serious consequences as a result of getting COVID-19. So they might know a lot of people who had mild cases, for example. If then anyone that they know who had more serious cases, they might say, well, it was someone who was, you know, far advanced in age with a lot of health conditions. And so I do wonder if there's that, you know, at what point that what we're talking about in terms of telling people about how it could become dangerous, you know, I mean, is there any, Can it, you kind of mentioned this, but can it go too far? I mean, it is true that it is still a minority of those who get COVID-19, who get seriously ill. If you look at the numbers, although I guess we don't really have figures for long haulers and things like that, but I guess survivability is high, relatively speaking.
Yeah, no, I mean, if you're young, the odds, you know, the odds favor, if you get it, that you will recover. And we just don't know enough to know, you know, whether you recover, but, you know, you're never quite the same, or you recover and you're pretty much the same. I mean, yeah. You know, the long haulers are a huge question mark that we shouldn't forget, but there's still a question mark. We really don't know how big a deal that is. Yeah. But I think you're right. I think, you know, the time is going to come when, you know, the most vulnerable people have been vaccinated. There will be still a cohort of people who are vulnerable, who don't think they're vulnerable, that are important to reach. But, you know, the larger group of people that you're then trying to reach are, as you say, people who have a pretty solid rationale for thinking that COVID-19 is not a big threat to them. And, you know, at that point, I think the messaging needs to be different. It needs to be, you know, all right, you know, you want the economy to recover. And one of the barriers to the economy, not, you know, to getting the economy back the way you want it, is there's too much illness around. And one of the reasons why there's too much illness around is because, you know, healthy people who are going to survive COVID-19 pretty well are infecting vulnerable people who aren't, and they're filling hospitals, and you know, the whole mood of the country is being undermined, and therefore the economy is being undermined. And yes, you're right that your job is more at risk than your health. But both your job and your health are at risk because too many people are not getting vaccinated. Am I making sense? So, I mean, I think
it's a fine.
So I think it is going to be important. You know, I mean, either we decide that healthy young people don't have to bother to get vaccinated, and we're gonna vaccinate the vulnerable, and that'll protect the hospitals, and you know, the death rate will go way down, and the hospitalization rate will go way down. And we'll just let the relatively low risk people get sick if they want to, and hopefully, you know, most of them will get better, and you know, probably their immunity will last reasonably well, although we, you know, probably not as well as if they were vaccinated, and you know, we'll get by that way. That's one path forward, is just not to sweat vaccinating the young. But if you're going to want to vaccinate the young, you're probably not going to appeal to them in terms of their own health, because they have pretty solid rationale for thinking their own health isn't greatly endangered. So you're going to have to, you know, you might talk about the health of people they care about. You know, if you're ever going to hug your grandma again, you probably ought to get vaccinated. But it's not a very strong appeal either, because, you know, they're going to say, well, my grandma got vaccinated. And she's not worried about hugging me. That, you know, that might work if the vaccine were only 50% effective. But vaccine's 95% effective. My grandma's willing to hug me, and she doesn't care if I'm not vaccinated. So what's your next argument? I'm not sure what the answer to that is, but I am sure of sort of two guiding principles. One is, you know, you don't ground an information campaign in misinformation. So telling people they're at greater risk than they are, or telling them that they're a greater risk to their grandma than they are, you know, dishonest campaigns are not a good basis for persuasion. That's out. And the other thing that makes this very difficult is, and this is a very important point. We are an individualistic culture. Mm-hmm. You know, the societies that have done the best jobs with pandemic management are either authoritarian or communitarian. Right. If you're authoritarian, you're used to taking orders. The government tells you to wear a mask, you wear a mask. Why are you wearing a mask? Because the government told you to wear a mask.
Right.
And that works. And if you're a communitarian society, you're used to doing what's good for the group, what's good for the society as a whole.
Right.
And you're wearing a mask because it's safer for all of us if we all wear a mask. And, you know, a lot of Asian societies are communitarian. A lot of societies, not just Asian, are either communitarian or authoritarian. China did a superb job of managing the pandemic, not as superb as it pretends, but still superb, because it is both authoritarian and communitarian. So you got society that is simultaneously communist and Confucian. You're in very good shape to tell people what to do in order to help their neighbors. The United States is neither communist nor Confucian. We are neither authoritarian nor communitarian. We are profoundly individualistic. And that means that any information campaign, any messaging about the pandemic should be grounded largely in individualistic appeals. People do not want to do what they're told. We're not that kind of society. They do not want to do what's good for strangers. We're not that kind of society. They want to do what's best for themselves and their loved ones. And the appeals that work best in our culture are the appeals that tell you how to do what's best for yourself and your loved ones. And that has all kinds of implications. I have urged people, messaging to focus more on explaining to people how risk budgeting works. to introduce the concept of a risk budget. Is it, Kimberly, is that a familiar concept to you?
It isn't. I'm sorry. I don't think.
No, it's all right.
I could guess.
Basically, we each get to decide how much risk we're willing to take, and, you know, how much risk we're willing to impose on the people around us. And then we get to allocate that risk. And that may be based partly on expert advice, but the experts don't have that much advice to give us. So it's going to be based largely on our own seat of the pants common sense. So what does that mean? Going out to dinner one time shouldn't set a precedent. Instead, it should use up a hunk of my risk budget, so I'm less likely to go out to dinner a few days later. Now, if I really want to get a haircut, maybe I shouldn't go out to dinner for a month. Is this beginning to make sense? If food delivery works for me, I can reallocate my grocery store risk budget, and that gives me a chance to go out to dinner more often, or get a periodic haircut, or hug my grandchildren, or whatever I want to do. There's a certain amount of risk I'm willing to take and impose on others. And I try to figure out what's most important to me, and I allocate my risk in terms of my own priorities. That's not easy to do because the data stinks. But people have a seat of the pants sense of, how many minutes in a grocery store equals how many minutes on the beach. If they want to spend more time on the beach, they need to spend less time in the grocery store. And that kind of you are in charge of your own risk. It's not just risk to you, it's risk to the people around you. So it's not, you live in a world where you are going to affect other people, but you're still in charge of you. Mm-hmm. And you get to decide how much risk you're willing to take and impose, and then you get to allocate it. And we, the government, or we, the experts, will help you understand that, X is more risky than you thought it was, and Y is less risky than you thought it was. And if you're working really, really hard not to open your mail until you've sprayed it with Lysol, you can stop doing that because that's really low risk, and you can take that effort and reallocate it in another area where the risk is higher. So we can guide your risk allocation, but it's yours, and you're not going to decide to do things exactly the same way somebody else does. So mm-hmm. when you see someone else doing something that you think is risky, instead of yelling at her, you might consider that she probably doesn't do things you do that are risky. She allocated her risk budget differently than you allocated yours. Or maybe this is the first time in a month she's done that. She saved up her risk budget, and you happen to be there the moment that she decided to take that risk for a change. The concept of risk budget not only helps us take responsibility for ourselves, which is how American society wants to work. We don't want to take responsibility for others, and we don't want the government to tell us what to do. We want to be in charge of ourselves. So this helps us take responsibility for ourselves, and it also helps us cut slack for other people because we understand that they are taking responsibility for themselves.
It would be so great to see a lot less shaming going on social media. I don't think it's been helpful. And I think another factor that I sort of struggle with when I look at what's going on is that, the pandemic is only one factor of the risk that people have to think about. If you can say, for example, well, I don't want to get my elderly grandmother sick, but what if she's going to die of something else? And what if she's older and you don't know if she's, how much more time you're going to have, if you don't know if they're going to still be around after a vaccine, just because of other factors. I mean, I've known people who've missed funerals because of this and because of the pandemic, but they never got to say goodbye because of the pandemic. And it's just a lot to to think about. And I just think every person is probably different in that assessment.
Absolutely. And, you know, and from this perspective of an old person, you know, I mean, the pandemic is a much higher percentage of my remaining healthy life than it is of your remaining healthy life. Mm-hmm. So my decisions about what risks to take are grounded in the idea that, you know, a 2-year pandemic is maybe, you know, 10 or 20% of how many healthy years I have left. It's a way smaller percentage of how many healthy years you have left. And so we make different risk budgeting decisions because we have a different life expectancy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Another question I wanted to ask, as we're going through this pandemic and as things are changing and as what kind of communication should be coming out of the federal government specifically, whether it means the White House, whether it means appointing a scientist to be the go-to person, do we bring back weekly CDC calls? You know, I've covered a few administrations and it's always been a little bit different how they do things, but we haven't heard a lot from the scientists, or when we did, we also heard from the president, who would, you know, say something different than the scientists would. How often should the public be hearing from officials, and should it be the president, or should it be President-elect Biden when he comes into office, or should it be someone else?
Well, I mean, it's a complicated answer. I think it's super important to sort of resurrect CDC as the central voice of science in the government, you know, which it has usually been vis-a-vis infectious diseases and certainly vis-a-vis, you know, urgent infectious disease outbreaks. You know, we have, you know, for a number of decades, we've looked to CDC for, you know, key guidance in those moments. And it, you know, it, we need to resurrect CDC. And there are superb players there. Ann Schuchat is still there.
Yes.
Nancy Messonnier is still there. They are people who have been the voice of CDC at other times. They would have been the voice of CDC this time if the White House hadn't shut them down. And, you know, hopefully they will be again the voice of CDC under you know, President Biden. So yes, we need to resurrect the CDC. We need a constant, stable, credible sort of voice of, you know, the scientific approach, or the what science can tell us about the pandemic, about the vaccine, about the new strain that seems to be coming out of the UK. You know, whatever the news is, you know, there needs to be a coherent voice of science. It should be the CDC. Having said that, the coherent voice of science is not the most important voice. It's been super important, mostly because it's been missing. You know, but if it's there, it adds value. But it's not as if everybody should shut up so that Ann Schuchat and Nancy Messonnier are the only people talking. That would not be a good idea. People need to hear from their political leaders. They need to hear from their religious leaders. They need to hear from, you know, local authorities of various kinds. And I am not a supporter of the speak with one voice school of crisis communication. Mm-hmm. The problem when you try to speak with one voice is people smell a rat. The folks that you're shutting up because they want to say something different from that one voice leak. And they get all the more credibility because you have tried to shut them up. The effort to speak with one voice, I think, is not wise. The effort for the people with the most knowledge to make sure they are among the voices speaking is important. You know, so I want CDC to be speaking out in ways that it hasn't been allowed to speak out. But I don't want to shut up everybody else. And the way normal people in urgent situations figure out what's true is they triangulate. They listen to a lot of voices, and this is all the more true with the internet, but it's much easier with the internet. But it was true before the internet. Triangulation dates way back, before the invention of the internet. People listen to different voices that they expect to have different points of view. And they see what messages are constant across those differences, and that they're sure is true. Now that's in conflict with the fact that people want to be on their team and they want to listen to the voices of their team, and if I don't trust you, I don't care what you say. I may even sort of rebel against what you say and boomerang to the other side. So, triangulation is not the only thing that's going on. Team spirit is also going on, and allegiance to the people you trust. But in a crisis, you're way better off if lots of people are talking and much of what they're saying is shared. For the most part, they're saying much the same thing in different ways. Mm-hmm. Then the public, as it triangulates, gets a sense that those shared factoids are true. And the things where one side says one thing and the other side says something else, you're not so sure that's true.
Mm-hmm. So is it the federal government's role then to, reach those groups that then reach individuals and to say, look, this is the message we want to get across. Here are the facts. Here's, what we know. Here's what we don't know. And just make sure they're constantly communicating with, those sort of intermediaries, I guess you could say.
Yes. I mean, the federal government should be doing that. Experts should be doing that. And ideologues who think the federal government and the experts are wrong should be doing that. Everybody who has strong opinions should be reaching out and trying to get other communicators to carry that message. One would expect that the messages that, if the White House and the CDC are on the same page, which is devoutly to be wished, it looks like it may be coming. If the White House and the CDC are on the same page, that's going to be a powerful message. But delivering it directly is worth doing, but it's not as important as hearing that message from people you know, hearing that message from people you trust, hearing that message with somewhat different kinds of angles or somewhat different emphases everywhere you go, and you begin to get the sense that that's the shared truth that we all know.
So something like a fireside chat that Roosevelt used to do, what would you think about bringing something like that back?
Once in a while, yeah. I mean, I guess I don't know the answer. Mm-hmm. Among the things we have learned from President Trump, it seems to me, is that the bully pulpit has its limits, and people can get sick of the bully in the bully pulpit. I don't think I would advocate, two or three or four times a week a presidential address to the nation about the pandemic. I think that's going to be overkill. I think the indirect messaging matters more than the direct messaging, but in moments of crisis, for sure.
What about someone like Dr. Fauci getting up there and doing that several times a week?
I'd have my cake and eat it too. I mean, I'd like to see, Fauci or Meissonier or Schuchat routinely talking to the media. And occasionally, on the Sunday talk shows and on the news programs and absolutely visible. But, I don't think I would want, three times a week, Fauci fireside chats either. It feels like too much. It feels too much of an effort to institutionalize official truth. And I don't think we're that kind of culture. Chairman Xi can do that, but not President Biden, I don't think, and not Tony Fauci either.
Mm-hmm. What about, I do feel like there's been a lot of, when I talk to people outside DC, again, one of the big things they keep pointing to is, how the scientific message has evolved, and not just on masks, but I was reading back to some stories from February, even early March, that said that with top experts, many of whom I've interviewed before and that I respect, who said this wasn't a big deal, people shouldn't worry, they should be far more worried about the flu and all those things. How often should experts get up and say, look, here's what we know, here's what we don't know, here's what we learn that's different? Should that be part of those regular calls to the media, or should it be something more public? How do you get that? How do you gain that trust after losing it because of how it was miscommunicated before, or incorrectly communicated before?
I mean, the question is exactly on target. And you've got the answer, I think, pretty much implicit in the way you asked the question. It is inevitable with a novel emerging infectious disease, it is inevitable that the experts are going to get some stuff wrong. Now, some of what they claim to get wrong, they didn't get wrong. They were dishonest to start with. I mean, they didn't misunderstand masks. They wanted to save masks for healthcare workers, so they lied about them.
Is that what you think happened?
Yes, that's what I think happened. They had data from a very early moment, from very early in the outbreak, they had data that masks were useful. And they already knew they were useful mostly as source control, not as PPE. They didn't want to tell people to wear masks, because the masks people would want to wear would be surgical masks and N95 masks, and they were in short supply, and hospitals needed them more than ordinary folks. And they consciously decided that, we need it more than you do, so don't use it, was an unappealing and complicated and selfish sounding message. And they would do better to just say masks aren't useful to you. Mm-hmm. I don't think that had to do with, with evolving data. That had to do with the, they were right early on that masks were in short supply. What if they had it all to do again? I think what they would say is, look, the surgical masks and the N95 masks, we really need, you guys can use, can make your own masks, or use t-shirts, or use kerchiefs, or pretty soon, given that capitalism works so well, there's going to be masks in the store for you. But don't use the masks we need. That would have been a way better message and a way more honest message, but they didn't think of it. But that's a side issue. You are absolutely right that with an evolving, a new phenomenon, you're going to make mistakes. Probably the most important thing to do is to tell people that beforehand. It's way easier to tell people that beforehand than to tell them after. To say, this is what we know so far, but we're not sure. This is our opinion so far. And you have to titrate it. It's not a matter of, everything is either certain or totally unknown. Some things you're pretty sure of. Some things you think are probably true, but you're not sure. Some things are kind of a half-assed guess, and some things you haven't a clue about. There's a lot of evidence that when experts communicate uncertainty, it's hard to communicate uncertainty, because your profession doesn't like it. You know, so even when experts say, here's what we think, but we're not sure, you know, the resulting story is likely to sound a lot more sure than the expert was trying to sound. So it's hard to get uncertainty through the through the media system. But you know, but experts have, you know, most of the time experts don't try. So insofar as they can, they need to say, look, we're not sure about this yet. We're still studying it. A very nice example right now is this, more communicable strain, or the more transmissible strain that seems to be circulating widely in the UK, especially in the London area, especially in England, that presumably is here already, although apparently not spreading here very much yet. And there's a lot they don't know about it. So, there are obvious questions, right? Is it more transmissible? The answer seems to be yes. They're not absolutely sure, but almost, they're reasonably sure it's more transmissible. Is it more virulent or deadly? They don't think so, but they're not sure of that yet either. Does it diminish the effectiveness of the vaccine? They're pretty sure it doesn't, and they have pretty good theoretical reasons for thinking it doesn't, but they haven't done any research yet to prove it doesn't. They're doing that research now. And they should know, even more definitely in a week or two. What should we do about it? How does it change which precautions work best? For example, does it change the ratio of droplets to aerosols? In which case it might change that, masks, if for example, it's more aerosol and less droplet, it would mean masks are a little bit less important than we thought they were, and ventilation indoors is more important, because one works better with droplets and the other works better with aerosols. So there are all kinds of questions that experts, now that this new strain is newsworthy and everybody's writing news stories about it, experts should be explaining those questions and saying what they know and what they don't know about the answers, and very aggressively warning that some of what they think the answers are, they're going to turn out wrong about, and they'll have better answers in a month, or maybe better answers day after tomorrow.
How often should they admit when they're wrong? I mean, is every blunder worth, going out and doing a press conference on? If, let's say that after the switch over to the new administration, that vaccine distribution goes horribly for whatever reason, how transparent should they be? And how often do you say, my bad, I messed up here?
But did you notice how much media attention Operation Warp Speed got just because General Perna acknowledged that he had messed up, the communication about logistics about, this week's supply to some states?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Perna said, that was my mistake. I'm sorry. And it was big news. It wasn't big news that he screwed up. It was big news that he said he screwed up. it was absolutely amazing. People were saying, oh my God, somebody in government has admitted that it's his fault. And there's absolutely no way that wasn't good for him.
Right, right.
Enormously more good than harm. It is certainly true that, the more often you screw up and the more often you have to come out and publicly say, I screwed up, the less interesting it is that you are candid about it, and the more interesting it is that you screwed up again. it's kind of like, the first time an alcoholic falls off the wagon, we're all interested in helping him or her get back on the wagon. But the the millionth time that someone falls off the wagon, they're just an alcoholic and we're not terribly interested anymore. So it's not as if admitting you messed up is a cure-all. You know, you're supposed to try to not mess up so much. There is no circumstance I can think of. Well, no, there is one circumstance I can think of where admitting you messed up does more harm than good. And the only time that admitting you messed up does more harm than good is when you are virtually certain that if you don't admit it, nobody will ever know. You kind of have to be a saint to admit you messed up when you're pretty damn certain you can keep it secret successfully. But that's rare.
Yeah.
And it's especially rare with something as interesting and important and newsworthy as a pandemic. But I mean, I used to routinely say to my clients, look, here's the math. I would say to my clients, if you admit you messed up, it does about 1/20th as much harm as if you try to keep it secret and it comes out, a whistleblower reveals it, or, you know, it comes out against your will. You try to keep it secret and you fail. That does 20 times as much harm. What that means is admitting you messed up is cost effective unless you can successfully keep it secret at least 95% of the time. Right. If it's going to do 20 times as much harm, then, you know, if you can only successfully keep it secret 90% of the time, you're better off revealing all your secrets. Did you follow that? Nobody has 95% success. I mean, you know, maybe in some other countries where you can disappear your critics, you might be able to manage 95% success in keeping your secret. But, you know, I think in this country, no organization has 95% success. Certainly corporations don't, and certainly Operation Warp Speed doesn't, and the Trump administration doesn't, and the Biden administration won't. So not acknowledging you screwed up is dumb. Ethics aside, you know, it's going to do 20 times as much harm when you get caught, and you'll get caught way more than one time in 20.
Yeah. One of the final questions I have has to do with the type of language that we've used, terms like shutdown orders, social distancing. Are those the best terms to use to help the public make choices about the pandemic, or should they consider alternate terms that might be, I don't know, more helpful to people?
Yes and no. Pretty much everybody agrees Operation Warp Speed was an unfortunate label because it implied, you know, cutting corners more than some other label might have implied. What label you give to things does make a difference, but not that much of a difference. And in particular, not enough of a difference for it to be smart to try to fight a label that has caught on. Yeah. So the effort to stop saying social distancing and start saying physical distancing is dumb. The effort to help force people to make a distinction between COVID-19, the disease, and SARS-CoV-2, the virus. I mean, that's a lost cause. It's not a COVID-19 vaccine, right? It's a SARS-CoV-2 vaccine. Good luck getting anybody to say that. fighting a label that has caught on is foolish. And in particular, if a label that has caught on has an implication that you regret, then I think you have to run through it rather than around it, and you have to accept the label and use the label and you know, make, you know, normalize the label so that it loses the connotation you're unhappy with. So I think virtually, you know, in more than 40 years of consulting on risk communication, pretty much any time my client was preoccupied with terminology, they were preoccupied with the wrong thing.
Okay.
Something I want to say that you haven't raised, but I think it's important. In talking about the vaccine, I think obviously the vaccine is hugely good news, and everybody knows it's hugely good news. I mean, there's a small percentage of the population that doesn't think it's hugely good news, but leave them aside. We should keep talking about how good news it is. Keep talking about what a miracle it is, how wonderful it is. We see the light at the end of the tunnel. But we should talk at least as much about the fact that we're still in the tunnel. And that the light at the end of the tunnel doesn't mean we're at the end of the tunnel. And, it's not rational to take more precautions because we're going to get vaccinated soon. I mean, it's normal. It's human. It's good. I mean, you know, one wants to laugh at it kind of gently rather than with hostility, because it is very, it's normal. It's like all those people who go out to a bar because the bars are being shut down tomorrow. Well, why are the bars being shut down tomorrow? Because it's dangerous to go to a bar. Why on earth are you going to one tonight? It's totally irrational, but it's totally human. We need to tell people how important it is to take precautions, and that it's because, you know, it's not take precautions even though there's a vaccine coming. It's take precautions all the more because there's a vaccine coming, because you don't want to, after 10 months of getting through this pandemic just fine, you don't want to get sick weeks before you could have been vaccinated. I think that's an important message right now. And I think the downsides of the vaccine need to be talked about more than they're being talked about. I haven't seen nearly enough coverage of, for example, of the fact that there will be, inevitably, will be just by coincidence, there will be people who become severely ill or die shortly after getting vaccinated. And there will be investigations to determine whether the vaccine killed them or it's a coincidence. And there will be stories on social media saying the vaccine killed them. And I think people aren't being prepared for that. They aren't being prepared to know that, you know, if you vaccinate millions of people, particularly if you vaccinate millions of elderly people in nursing homes, some of them are going to die the next week. Mm-hmm. Some of them would have died the next week anyhow. And get ready to face news stories about the question of whether the vaccine killed them, and get ready to pay attention to the possibility that that's true, but the likelihood that that's a coincidence.
Right.
Similarly, I think, get ready for glitches in the rollout, not just in the distribution, which has been well covered, but in manufacturing. It would shock me if it doesn't happen at some point in January or February or March, that there's an announcement that a major shipment of vaccine isn't coming because there was a screw up at a plant.
Right.
It's going to happen, and get people ready for that to happen. So all kinds of anticipatory guidance, that's the term of art, for telling people that bad stuff is likely and they should expect it and take it in stride when it happens. And I think with all the totally justified joy about the pandemic, we're not, I don't mean about the pandemic, I'm sorry, with all the totally justified joy about the vaccines, we're not doing as well as we should to put that in context and to talk about, you know, the 5 or 6 or 7 negatives that are relevant. I mean, another one that comes to mind is we still don't know to what extent the vaccines reduce transmission. Mm-hmm. So it is you probably know this already. The vaccines are proven to reduce illness, but not proven to reduce transmission. They might reduce transmission. They probably do, at least to some extent, but we don't know to what extent. And it's possible that they don't reduce transmission at all. So we may have a situation where vaccinated people are dangerous to unvaccinated people, mm-hmm. because they can still get and transmit the virus even though they don't get sick. And so they're going to have to wear masks, at least until we know the answer to that question. I don't think we're telling people that enough, to make that part of, you know, yes, it's wonderful news, but it's wonderful news with, you know, a handful of downsides that don't make it less wonderful, but they will feel like they're ruining it all if we save them up and make them surprises.
Right. It's true. And since I have you, this isn't really a question for my story, but I'm curious if you have any takeaways for how the news media has covered this crisis in the United States. Sometimes I wonder if we hurt some of the trust, or, you know, if we perhaps jumped the gun on a lot of stories. And, you know, I just see on social media a lot of people, you know, saying, for example, that there was a lot of fact checking about the president predicting that a vaccine would be approved for emergency use before the end of the year. And then a lot of stories saying, no, it wouldn't. And here we are, and it's before the end of the year. Do you have any advice or do you have any takeaways from what you've noticed about coverage of this crisis?
Well, I mean, certainly your example speaks to something that's just, you know, true, which is, you know, I mean, the mainstream media have generalized from all the good reasons to be unhappy with Trump into a generalization that anything Trump does is wrong. And, you know, so Operation Warp Speed had to be, you know, a fraud because Trump did it. And the vaccine rollout had to be moving too fast because Trump did it. You know, and it, I mean, it's not just about the pandemic, you know, it's like these peace deals with between Israel and various Arab countries have to be a bad thing because Trump did it. That's too bad. I mean, you know, I mean, yeah. You know, I mean, however monstrous you think President Trump is, if you can't list 10 things he did that you hope President Biden won't undo, you haven't been paying attention. you know, and, you know, clearly Operation Warp Speed is one of them. Media coverage of the pandemic has been, you know, good in some ways and bad in some ways, but certainly one of the ways in which it's been bad is, you know, the coverage of Trump's role in the pandemic has contributed to the polarization. Obviously, Trump's behavior contributed manifestly to the polarization. I'm not saying, you know, Trump was a great president if only the media had covered him right. You know, that's not what I'm saying. But the media coverage of the pandemic has been worse than it would have been if we'd had a president in charge that the media weren't determined to hate.
And so that means pointing out when something is positive or when it's been a success.
Yeah, and pointing out when something might be a success. The president has undermined many, many norms, and some of the norms he undermined, especially in this unprecedented emergency, probably needed undermining.
Oh, like, like, you know, what?
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, I don't know how fast vaccine development in the United States would have taken place under a president Clinton. I mean, obviously, nobody knows the answers to counterfactual, hypothetical scenarios. But I think it is sort of demonstrably true that we had a president who said, you know, I don't care what it takes. I want this done faster. Mm-hmm. And he got it done faster. And he got it done faster against the intuitions of a lot of the scientists at FDA. FDA is famously cautious. One of its biggest claims to fame is it never approved thalidomide and turned out right. FDA would enormously rather people died because the drug was unavailable than because the drug was deadly.
A
death is a death is a death, but a death because a drug hadn't been approved yet, nobody gets blamed for. A death because a deadly drug was approved and heads roll in the regulatory agency responsible. So it's absolutely inevitable that FDA, if left to itself, would move slower than the emergency called for. And I think you can make a pretty good case that a different president might have left FDA more to itself.
Okay. Right.
The downside of all of that is, you know, that means that the people who are worried about cutting corners are not crazy. I can't have it both ways. I can't say Trump genuinely hurried things and say, but don't worry, he didn't make them cut corners. I mean, yeah.
Right.
It's double-edged.
Yeah, and they did end up pushing back and adding another layer of, you know, approval and everything. So I know that there was sort of that. But it really was only after all the reporting on how much the Trump administration was pressuring the FDA, and then it might have sort of, you know, felt like, okay, we have to instill trust here with the public, because there's no point putting a vaccine out that people will refuse to take because they worry
That's
about.
That's right. So they slow, that, you know, starting in October, the FDA slow walked it. They added a new advisory in October with more criteria. They agreed with Pfizer not to take the first peak at 32 cases, which would have happened in October. The FDA did a bunch of things starting in October to move slower. Who knows? I mean, this is not risk communication. It's not stuff I have real expertise in. So I'm way out of my field here, but I think you can make a pretty good case that, you know, if not for Trump, if Trump hadn't pushed the FDA, it would have taken longer to get vaccines. And I think you can make a pretty good case that if Trump had shut up about the fact that he was pushing the FDA, we would have had vaccines quicker.
Mm.
So he pushed them and then he boasted about pushing them, so they had to slow down.
Got it. Right. So it ends up being kind of this. Yeah, I get what you're saying. I know I've already taken up so much of your time. I just love this topic. It's been fascinating to speak with you. There's so much to unpack, and there's, you know, coming out of this, it's just amazing to me looking at this crisis. You know, there's a lot of pieces to my story, everything from making testing more available to making sure that we know, you know, where the outbreaks are, who they're occurring in, and, you know, providing another stimulus, and having targeted restrictions in certain areas of the country. It's amazing just how much of that is the messaging piece of this is really so key to all of those things. I really appreciate your willingness to speak with me about this.
Yeah. It's a very complicated topic and obviously dear to my heart. And, you know, we skimmed the surface of, you know, whatever was at the top of my mind and the top of your mind, and not necessarily, we could do the interview again tomorrow and talk about completely different things.
It's true. True.
But I hope this was helpful. Kimberly, yeah. I posted just a day or so ago on my website a new column on what I think the key messages are right now. I think it's entitled something like Four Key Messages for Our Cold, Dark Pandemic Winter.
Yeah. Yeah. It's important to get it right.
So I'm not asking you to promo that, although I'm happy if you do, but you might want to look at it and if it says some things that we didn't talk about, you know, feel free to draw from the column as you would from the interview.
Okay, great. You know, I think I do have one other thing. Is that okay? One other question?
Absolutely.
Because I have this open, I have this, you know, the idea of the fireside chat. Because I was just reading, you know, different ways that our leaders have approached major crises before. And you said, you know, you would recommend instead working through the different networks that people belong to, so they're hearing multiple messages, but also so they're hearing these messages from the teams that they belong to, whether it's, you know, their churches or the political leaders or, you know, anything else. And is there, you know, that was something that was thought to have worked well for Roosevelt. Is there a reason why you think it might work not so well now? Is there anything that's changed in our culture that makes this, you know, different? Is it just because there's so many messages everywhere? You know, there's social media, there's television, there's alerts on your phone, newsletters. So I was curious why you think it's different now.
Yeah, I may be wrong. You know, I mean, I'm tempted to say, well, you know, we're just a much more polarized society than we were then. But you know, I mean, Roosevelt was profoundly unpopular with a huge number of people. So maybe, you know, it's not, I can't really, you know, I'm not much of an historian, but I can't really claim that Roosevelt had a united country and we have a polarized country. So fireside chats work for him and they wouldn't work for us. I'm not sure why they work for him. I'm not sure to what extent they actually did work for him, or we have romanticized that in hindsight.
Okay.
And I'm not convinced that they won't work for us. I mean, my intuition is that people want to hear that messaging. They want to hear overlapping, similar messaging from their own leadership structures.
Okay.
More than they want to hear the president day after day telling them what's new today. But you know, I'm not sure I'm right. It would be interesting, for example, to study the impact of Governor Cuomo's daily news conferences for the several months that he did daily news conferences about the pandemic in New York. And I haven't seen any effort to study how well that worked with the New York public. It worked spectacularly well with the media, who decided that Cuomo is a wonderful communicator and started giving him awards. I don't know how well it worked with the public.
Did he ever admit to, and I don't follow, you know, New York very closely specifically, because even though we're a New York based publication, I'm part of our Washington, D.C. bureau. So I work out of D.C. But did he ever admit to the mistakes of, you know, having so many people sent to nursing homes and causing?
What do you think admit means? He never took the blame.
Okay.
You know, he said it was, at one point he said it was the CDC's fault. At one point he said it was the hospital's fault or the nursing home's fault, or, you know, he had a number of different explanations for why so many people in New York nursing homes died. He had the health department do a study which purported to show that they didn't die because, folks got sent home prematurely from the hospital to the nursing home. The thing he certainly never did is what Perna did a couple of days ago, which is to stand up and say, I made a bad call. I thought that was the right thing to do because I was worried about hospital beds and I wasn't sufficiently worried about spread inside the nursing homes, and I blew it. and people died because I blew it. It's very hard to have the courage to do that. I have had maybe 10 or 12 times in my career, I've had a client to whom I had to say, now is when you have to go before the cameras and say you killed people. You know, you're the CEO of this mining company, and you just had a cave-in, and they died, and it's on you, and you have to sound like you know it's on you, you know, or you're the Secretary of Health of this city, you're the Commissioner of Health of this city, and you told people to stay home unless they had a fever, and they stayed home, and they stayed home too long, and by the time the ambulances got to them, they were dead, and it's on you, and you have to say so. I mean, you know, it's hard to do. Cuomo certainly never did it. And I would like to say, and that has done him enormous harm, but I, you know, doesn't seem to have hurt him at all. He's, you know, he's way more admired than I think he deserves to be.
Could you ever picture President Trump doing that?
No, I can't picture President Trump doing that. But, you know, the more painful point for me is I certainly would have advised Cuomo to do that. And all the evidence seemed to suggest that he was right not to.
Would you advise President Trump to do that?
To take blame? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes. You know, not although I have to say, you know, I mean, it probably doesn't matter. I mean, you know, can you imagine anything Trump could say in the way of, all right, here's, you know, I did X wrong. You know, I mean, let's take it away from the pandemic. Imagine Trump saying tomorrow, all right, look, you know, obviously Biden is going to be the next president, and I should have said so weeks ago. The country would breathe a sigh of relief, but I don't know that you know, MSNBC would like Trump any more than it does today.
That apparently is kind of how the president thinks about it, as he, in terms of apologizing, as he thinks it's not worthwhile to him.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I have built a career out of, in part out of telling my clients that, you know, when you screwed up, saying so is in your long-term interest. I you know, there are some counter examples, and Cuomo is certainly so far a counter example. He screwed up, he didn't admit it, and his reputation is in fine shape.
Right. Yeah, it's difficult to picture. Well, this is fascinating. I could speak with you so much longer. And I'm going to use as much of the interview as I can, but I'm glad that you're also going to post it, because, you know, hopefully a lot of people can benefit from the information that you've shared with me. I know I have, and I feel like I have lots more story ideas now too.
Well, my pleasure, and you know, feel free to get back in touch if you see another way I can be of use to you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I'll send this over. Will the file be too large, or are you on Gmail? That should work if you're, let's see.
I mean, if you can just flat out email the file, because it's audio files usually aren't that long, aren't that big,
Sure.
That would be best. If you can't, then put it in Dropbox and I'll take it down from there.
Okay, I will do that. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful holiday season.
Thank you, you too.
Bye-bye.
Right, bye-bye.